God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. Newcomers, is there anyone here tonight in your first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you. Feel free to unmute yourself and say hello. Anybody, first 30 days.
Hi, my name is Matthew. I'm a recovering alcoholic.
Matthew, welcome. Glad you're here. Anybody else? All righty then. So let's see. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. So you guys are here on a great night. The format of this meeting is an open speaker ask it basket. We're very excited to have Doug R. from Los Angeles, California as our guest tonight. After Doug tells his story, we're going to take a short break around the top of the hour, and we'll call for a few announcements, do the seventh tradition, and then we'll reconvene and have a question and answer, ask it basket type format. So think about that. You'll see a red question mark user. It's really Larry. But he's the user questions, and you can send any questions that you think of at any time you'd like through the chat to him, and we'll consolidate those and then ask Doug. So I'll remind you about that later. In the meantime, I don't want to take up another minute of Doug's time. I give you Doug R. from Los Angeles. Thank you so much for coming tonight.
Thanks, David. That was cool. I thought you were going to have a like reading chapter 5 of the traditions or something like that. My name is Doug Rao, and I am a grateful alcoholic. I'm grateful to be an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have something's wrong with my voice lately. I don't know if it's lungs or throat or just it might be just getting old. I know a lot of old men sound like this. So that could be it. So if anybody's heard me talk before and I happen to sing a song, that's not going to happen tonight. but I want to thank David for inviting me to come and do this. I like doing this. You know what? I wanted to be the speaker at the first meeting I ever went to. But I was a little drunk that night, so they didn't, nobody asked me to do it. I would have, and I know that some speakers really don't like doing it. They do it because they're of service and they do what they're supposed to do. But they, you know, you call them and ask them to come, and they go, "Oh yeah, yeah, I will." And then they just dread it. So then they give a talk that's so spiritual. You know, nobody would drink between here and Baltimore. You know. For the next 24 hours, but I'm not like that. I don't know if I'm a good speaker or not, but I don't care. I'm the guy tonight, and I enjoy doing it. Like I said, I want to be the speaker at the first meeting I went to. First meeting I went to, I didn't go to get sober. I'll tell you a little history of how I got to my first meeting. For one thing, you know, when you start to come to AA, and somebody will tell you, either a sponsor or just some well-meaning member, look for the similarities, not the differences. You know, and I don't know, if you like me, you go, yeah, yeah, right. that's what it, yeah, okay, I sure will. But, you know, but we look for the differences. We're mostly looking for a reason for we don't have to be here. And either that we're not an alcoholic or we're a different kind of alcoholic. That's what I thought I was. I had a couple of friends that had gotten sober. So I knew that the people in AA didn't drink at all. Some people come in here and think they're going to learn how to drink right. But I didn't have any illusions like that. I had a couple of friends who had gotten sober in AA. And so I knew that the people in AA do not drink. That's the deal around here. And the ones who do get looked down upon. I made that part up, but that's what it seemed like to me. And I wanted to see what AA was in case my drinking got really bad, you know. Now, obviously I had some incidents that brought me to check out AA with some idea that maybe my drinking might get really bad. Like, for instance, I had a daughter. Well, when I graduated from high school, I never had a drink till I was 18 years old. And I just didn't care about it. There was no drinking in my family to speak of. My dad enjoyed a beer once in a while. Saturday afternoon, he might be working in the yard or working on his car or, you know, watching a football game. And he would stop and have a beer. And then he would go back to what he was doing, which is some kind of drinking that I don't understand, because the way I figured, whatever I'm doing, if I stop and have a beer, that is now what I'm doing. What I'm doing now is having a beer and then more beer. And so my dad wasn't an alcoholic at all. He would buy a six pack of beer and drink one and then not remember if he had any beer. If somebody came over, "Ed, you got any beer?" "Yeah, I think so. I think. And I was like 8 years old. "Dad, remember Saturday you bought a six pack? You drank one? There's five in the fridge right now. They've been in there all week. You got to move them to get the lettuce out." And my mom, my mom's different. My mom, we never could tell if she was an alcoholic or not, because she wouldn't drink. I mean, she didn't drink at all. And so when I asked her one time, "Why don't you drink?" She said, "I don't know. You know, when I was young, my friends drank. I drank with them. And every time I drank, I got sick, stupid, and obnoxious. So I quit. I stopped." And I said, "You got to drink through that, Mom. You know, the promised land lies beyond sick, stupid, and obnoxious." But my mother did not have the tenacity to make this program. But consequently, since there was really no, and I was four kids, and I was the oldest of them, and the only boy. My three younger ones were all sisters, and I grew up in it. It was a happy family. I mean, we really were. We laughed a lot. We sang. You know, we would go on little excursions together, and you know, and stuff. My dad painted the family pickup truck my high school colors. I don't know if that gives you an idea. My wife and her talk likes to say, "Yeah, they were that family, and we were that family." So there was really no drinking in the house. I didn't care about drinking. What happened to me is my friend Morris, who was he was my sex sponsor. You know, he was more advanced, and Morris said to me, "Doug, if you want to get a home run with this girl," because we used to use those baseball terms. You know, there was a first base and a second base and a third base and then obviously home run. I don't remember where the bases are. There's not enough bases, really. But you know, Billy got the second base. "All right, Billy." You know, but I wanted that home run thing. And Morris said, "If you want to get a home run, you got to get her drunk." So I heard that. So I stole a quart of Rainier Ale from out of the back of this liquor store in Garden Grove, California, where I grew up. Seemed like Rainier Ale was the national beverage of Garden Grove. So this girl and I went and parked by the railroad tracks, and we had been there before and, you know, necked or made out or whatever. But now I got my ammunition And I still didn't care about drinking. I would have been happy to say, here, drink this and let me know when you're ready. You know? But it just seemed rude. So I cracked the top on that Rainier Ale and had a little pull on it. And as I recall, it tasted like carbonated dishwater, but I wasn't there for the taste. I had a whole other agenda. And so I handed it to her and she drank some and passed it back. And we killed that bottle in about 5 minutes and pretty much split it evenly. And I started to get this feeling that I never felt before. It was warm and I felt bright, clever, and mostly cool. I felt cool. And I knew what cool was. And I like, cool is one of those words that has survived generations, back from the flappers to the greatest generation, to the beatniks, to the hippies, to the Gen X's and the mods and rockers and the millennials. Everybody knows what cool is. And I knew what cool was. I knew what it looked like. I could identify it in somebody else, and I knew I wasn't until that moment. That moment with that half a quarter Rainier Ale in me, I knew what cool was, and it was me. And also, I knew that anyone who looked at me would know I was cool. Now that's a significant moment in your life. So this was the first time I ever had an alcohol buzz. And as it turns out, the first time I ever had sex in front of a witness. So I thought, hey, I'm going to do both of these things as much as I can the rest of my life. So we talk about commitments in AA. That's a commitment. And I did, and I was 18. So, you know, I couldn't buy booze legally, but every time I had a chance, I drank some and graduated from high school. And I was playing guitar. I was playing in some little musical venues around town, making a couple of bucks. Then I got an electric guitar. Whenever the Beatles brought over the British invasion, you know, and the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the Animals and the Yardbirds changed the face of popular music from Kingston Trio and Peter, Paul, and Mary to the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the Yardbirds and the Animals. And it changed. I was playing in a rock and roll band, and I moved from Orange County about 60 miles north up to Hollywood, lived there with some friends of mine who were also musicians. And I was playing in a band that played in Hollywood four nights a week. And it was a good life. And then I got a job singing and dancing in a show, a Broadway show called Hair. They came to town, they came to Hollywood, and I went and saw it. And I called them up and said, hey, I want to be in your show. And they said, can you sing and dance? And I said, yeah, that's how I put gas in my car. And that's how I pay my rent. But I never danced a step in my life. I was up on a bandstand watching you dance. I'm playing good dancing, good bad dancing. How hard can that be? So I went to the audition and I sang them a couple of songs and they liked it. And they said, we just want to see you dance. Now, I had sort of accidentally taken a drug before I showed up for that audition. I didn't take it for the audition, and it wasn't a heavy drug. What it was THC. It was just a little capsule. It was laying on my roommate's dresser, and I thought, I wonder what that is. Well, because, you know, we didn't have a PDR. You pretty much had to swallow test everything. It's a good test. You know, forget about automotive vehicles and heavy machinery. If you eat it, you're going to know precisely what it does. And you can share that with your friends. And if somebody dies, don't eat the green shit. So this turned out to be THC, synthetic marijuana. And so when it got to the dance audition, I could dance. I didn't know for sure. The guy started to play and I started to move. And I heard one of the audition people who were auditioning, judging the auditioners said, oh my God, can this guy dance? And I thought so. So they hired me, and but I thought I was auditioning for the Hollywood show, but it turned out I was auditioning for, they were having auditions for the Las Vegas show, which is about 300 miles from Los Angeles. And so they hired me, and I went to Las Vegas and played here for 6 months in the company, in the tribe, learn the dances and the songs and the lines. And 1970 was a funny place to be a hippie in Las Vegas, because Las Vegas wasn't attracted to hippies for the most part at that time. Now the desert was, you know, out by Hoover Dam and the wide open Mount Charleston and all the wide open desert spaces. But in the middle of Las Vegas is the brightest city in the United States. And it was mostly attracted to people who were dressed nicely and, you know, came there on vacation. And so these, as hippies, we were pretty noticeable. It was a fun life. But we left Las Vegas after 6 months and became the national tour of Hair. And it was a fun job. People would come up on stage. Oh, and they gave me the lead role when we became the national tour. The lead role, Berger, the obnoxious, speed freak, sex-crazed leader of the tribe. It was a stretch, you know, but I could do it. And and it was just, it was a good job. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll, set to music, and paid union scale, and traveled around the country. What a great job. And people would come up on stage afterward and say, listen, man, we own a bar up the street. We want your whole company to come up there and drink for free all night. Well, it was good for the bar, and it was great for us. So we'd do that. Excuse me. And people would come up on stage. Hey, man, you like pot? Send to me in Maui, Waui, Panama Red, Acapulco, go. Give us all this great dope, because we could sing and dance. I don't understand the connection, but we just, you know, Nancy Reagan said, just say no. We said, just say thanks. So you like acid, Osley, purple haze, orange sunshine, window pane. Nay, 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 nay. Some girl would come up on the stage afterwards and go, oh my God. Oh, I love you. Take me. We'd go, okay. You know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And it was a fun job, really. We looked, at, by the end of that 3.5 years, I had hooked up with a lady in the show, and she got pregnant, and we had a little girl. And when we came back to LA, we set up housekeeping, and she went to work doing office temp work for Kelly Girl. And I went down to Goodwill and bought a car seat and welded some brackets on it so it would fit on the back of my Harley. And then my little one-year-old daughter and I, my little one-year-old daughter in diapers in this car seat on the back of my chopped Harley, riding around Hollywood with no helmet, you know. And really, and it's funny how I thought I was a good parent, because I had my kid with me all day. I kept care of my kid while my wife was working. And I really wasn't a good father. I was fun, and I cared about my daughter, but I was real careless, you know. And I would go visit friends and get loaded. And I took her with me to auditions and, you know, and just right and into bars and just, you know, and people loved her. She was so cute. And I cheated on her mother. I mean, I was a bad father, but I was a worse husband. And finally, her mother said, look, I can't do this anymore. I know you love your baby and she loves you. And I want you to be in her life, but not in mine. Get the hell out. Leave us alone. So I did. I moved out, and I ended up going to work in television. And there's a lot of in Hollywood, they talk about the business, you know. The business, depending on what city you're in, one city it might be construction, one city it might be police work, you know. In Washington, D.C., the business maybe is politics. I don't know. But in Hollywood, the business is show business, television and movies and stage work and recording. And so there's a lot of that kind of work around. So I ended up being a prop man for TV, stagehand. And I started out with a pretty good reputation because I was young and strong and smart. And I had some theater background, so I kind of knew how the thing worked. And, you know, and I'm a friendly guy. So I started out doing really great. But the more I drank and used, the worse my reputation started to get. Got it so that people, initially, when people would see me come on the call, they go, oh, great, Doug is here. We can trust him with anything. And finally, it got to the point where it'd be like, oh my God, Doug is here, you know? And if I was good, I was fine. I was good. But other times I might fall asleep and miss a cue, or I might drop something during a shooting, you know, and break it and they have to start all over again. Or sometimes I just wouldn't show up. I'd be too drunk to show up. And it started to go downhill like that. I went to pick up my daughter one time when she was about 12 years old. And I was supposed to pick her up at noon in her mom's house, about 15 miles from my house. We were going to go see a movie, have dinner, spend the night at my house, hang out during Sunday, all day Sunday, go visit friends, you know, maybe see another movie. I don't know, whatever we wanted to do. And then I bring her home Sunday evening. That was the plan. And we had done that sometimes. But this one particular Saturday, I got there at noon like I was supposed to, but I was already drunk. And I didn't mean to be drunk going to pick up my kid. But I was, and I tried to act like I was just in a silly mood, and I didn't fool anybody. By the way, if there's anybody new in here, let me give you a hint. If somebody says to you, have you been drinking? They already know the answer, so you can save yourself some debate time. So when my daughter's stepfather walked me out on the front porch and he said, Doug, you're drunk. I said, I am. Because what am I going to do? Say I'm not when I am. And he said, well, I'm not going to let Starshine get in the car with you. She couldn't help it. Her parents were hippies. We named her Starshine. And he said, I can't let Star get in the car with you. And I knew, I understood that. In fact, he was right. In fact, I was relieved that I didn't have to drive drunk with my daughter in the car. And I was also embarrassed and ashamed that I was going to drive drunk with my daughter in the car with me. And to be caught like that. And he didn't do it to insult me. He liked me. I liked him. There was no hostility between us. But because he was a good father. In fact, that's part of what hurt. He was a good father, and I was a bad father. My daughter's stepfather has to protect her from me. He said, Doug, I want you to know you're welcome in our home anytime, sober. Don't come over here drunk anymore. It's very hard on Star. He didn't say, don't come over here drunk. You'll embarrass us in front of our neighbors. Don't come over here drunk. We're afraid you're going to break our nice furniture. We're afraid you might fall in the pool and drown. He said, don't come over here drunk. It's very hard on Star. He's protecting my only child from me. And he should, because that's what a good father does. Boy, none of that got past me. There's none of that that I didn't recognize. And it killed me. It was like a knife in my heart. And it's that kind of pain that starts out and then it gets worse and it keeps getting worse. And at one point you think, oh my God, maybe this pain will always keep getting worse, no matter what, forever. That's what it feels like. And I had to go. I said, Stu, I'm sorry. I was looking forward to this. He said, so was she. So were we. But it's not going to happen. I said, I won't. He said, don't come over here drunk anymore. I said, I won't. It'll never happen again. And I got in my car and I started to drive away and I got about halfway down the block and the tears just opened up like Niagara Falls. I couldn't even see to drive. I was trying to wipe tears out of my eyes. I turned the windshield wipers off, which seemed like a good idea with absolutely no help. And I got out on the main thoroughfare and I knew I was just in danger. So I pulled in this little strip mall and I opened up my car door and I put my feet on the pavement and my head in my hands and I sobbed like a baby and I couldn't endure this pain. And I looked up and I saw this red neon sign that said liquor. And I walked over there and I handed the guy a $10 bill and he gave me a pint of whiskey. And I came back to my car And I sat in the car and I cracked the top on that bottle. And I had a little sip. And then I had another one. And the pain was gone. Gone. Pain was gone. That palpable pain that I thought would never quit was gone just like that. With two sips of a liquid. And they say to us, why do you drink? You know what it does to you. I do. And you don't know what it does for me. It's like when Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob came to visit Bill Dotson in the hospital. And Dotson said to him, look, I know why you guys are here. People have talked to me about my drinking before. It never does any good. I usually drink on the way home, so don't waste your time. And you know what they said? We didn't come to talk to you about your drinking. We came to tell you about our drinking. And they did. And Dotson heard them. And they left and they came back the next day. And Bill Dotson's wife was there. And he said, honey, these are the guys I told you about. The ones who understand. If you're new, Matthew, that's where you are. You're with the people who understand. And you're not going to find a group of us anywhere else. Alcoholics Anonymous are people who understand. In fact, whenever I tell this story in an AA meeting, there's heads nodding. There's heads nodding in this Zoom room. Because you understand. And if you tell this story at a PTA meeting, they have a whole different reaction. You know, they look at you like you're some kind of unfit parent, you know, like, I'm sorry, sir. Excuse me. It sounded like you were so distraught over your drinking that you drank. Yes, ma'am. That's exactly what happened. And then I could drive. So I hope you weren't on Tampa Avenue that day because I am a genuine danger to myself and others. But you know what I did? All of a sudden, I felt relieved. And I called my friend Teddy. I went to a payphone. We didn't have cell phones then. I went to a payphone. I called my friend Teddy. I said, what are you doing? She said, I'm not doing anything. What? Why? I said, let's go get drunk and be somebody. She said, you're on, buddy. Pick me up. So I went and picked her up. And I loved to go drinking with Teddy. She was so much fun. She was just like, she's just this crazy drunk woman. She would do anything. And when I was with her, I would do anything. Maybe she only did anything when she was with me because I would do anything. But we were just crazy people. And you know, if you go drinking with Teddy, there's a good chance you might get in a fight because she had a mouth on her. Or you might end up in handcuffs. That happens too sometimes. But it's worth it because she's so much fun. So I went and picked her up and we went drinking. And Teddy was with me. We had a sort of a semi-romantic relationship. But it was really more about the drinking. You know, we never were faithful to each other and didn't ask each other to be. And sometimes we had a romantic moment. And mostly we had a drunk moment. And, you know, and we would take any drug that anybody offered. And Teddy was with me when I went up skiing at Mammoth. We were skiing at Mammoth and I skied off a cliff. It wasn't an accident. I thought I could do it. It was like this 50-foot cliff, and it was right after the Winter Olympics, and you know those guys, they ski jump like 170 meters out through the air, and they all lean over the front of their skis. I thought they did that because it looked cool, because it does look cool, but no. It turns out if you don't do that, your skis will go straight up in the air, and now you're heading for the planet with the skis on top and your head on the bottom. And you'll never find an article in Ski Magazine about how to unweight with your skis on top and your head on the bottom. You're not supposed to do that. So that's how I landed. But fortunately, my arm hit first and I broke my shoulder. And Teddy had to drive the van back down to L.A. And I went in the hospital and they operated on my shoulder. And I was out of work for 6 weeks. And I got back to work. Everybody was happy to see me again. And I was working about another month. and somebody had a party that lasted all night, Friday night party. Saturday morning, the woman that owned the house said, somebody will take me to the store and get some eggs. I'll make breakfast. So I said, come on, Ted, let's go get some eggs. So we started to go get some eggs, and then it was such a beautiful April morning. The sun was just coming up over the horizon, and we had that Harley rumble going, and there was no helmet law then. So our hair is flying in the air. Everything about it was so sexy. We thought we should make love in the great outdoors, and then we'll get some eggs. So, but I don't know if anybody here is familiar with downtown Burbank, but there's not a lot of great outdoor lovemaking venues. The city of Burbank is not interested in providing that for their public, evidently, but we found a four-story parking structure. And we, there it is. We'll go up to the top of that parking structure, have the whole thing to ourselves. Nobody can see us. The sky is open, beautiful, but the gate was locked. So we went around to the fire escape, parked the bike, run up the fire escape, and the door was locked. And I said, fire escape doors are unlocked from the inside. I'm jumping over that wall and open that door. So I jumped up to the wall, and the part about getting over wasn't as easy as I thought it was going to be. I wasn't as agile as I thought I was that night. Turns out I had a 0.40 blood alcohol level. I know that because this was the parking structure of St. Joseph's Hospital. So when I fell 54 feet from this four-story parking lot, landed feet first on the ground, but my knees buckled and I kicked myself in the ass and broke my pelvis in two places and snapped the heel bone off my right foot and shoved it through my foot like a bowling ball. So I did not walk away from it. I laid there moaning. Ted thought I was dead. Oh my God. And she saw I was alive and she ran into the ER and she said, help me, my friend just fell off your parking lot and it broke him. He's easy to find. He's right at the bottom of the fire escape. So they came and got me, and I was in that hospital for 10 days while they tried to figure out how to put my foot back together, because my foot looked like a tetherball with toes. You know, it didn't break the skin, but it just swole up like a bag of bones because there was a lot of action inside that foot, and the skin turned from to black and blue and orange and green and yellow. You never saw so many colors on a piece of skin. And when you see that ball at the end of your own leg, you know this is not right. This is an unfortunate accident. So I was in the hospital for 10 days, and they finally, I was in surgery for 8 hours, and they managed to make my foot look like a foot again, and told me, don't put any weight on it. So while I was in the hospital for 10 days, friends were bringing me in gifts, you know, and as I never said to the doctor, I should have, to the doctors, excuse me, I know you're giving me Demerol and Percodan for the pain. I'm self-administering cocaine and Irish whiskey. Is that going to be a conflict? And I don't even remember thinking about that. But if I had, I would have thought, I'm in the hospital. It's not like they got to come find me somewhere. What's the worst that could happen? Code blue in room 322. Anyway, I got out of the hospital after 10 days. But here's an interesting thing. Teddy got sober while I was recuperating. And I always thought that was fascinating that I fell off a four-story building and she hit bottom. And I used to kid her about that. And everybody, I swear to God, anybody who knew Teddy was thrilled that she went to AA, because she was going to die. She was going to drink herself to death or kill somebody, or somebody would kill her, you know, or just, you know, drive off a cliff or something. But she got sober. And I swear to God, within less than 2 weeks, she turned into a lady in every sense of the word. And everyone who loved her was amazed. Have you seen Ted? Oh my God, what a transition. Can you believe it? And we were all happy for her, except that every time you talk to her, she's got to throw things into sentences like meetings and sponsor and books and steps. And finally, I just told her, hey, Ted, shut up, okay? Look, I know you mean well. I don't know if you're trying to draft me into your deal or what, but let me tell you this. If I ever see alcohol interfering with my life, I probably will go to AA. And she just, her chin hit her chest, you know, like, oh, she said, are you kidding me? Jesus, Doug, what would you call interference? Brain death? And I said, I see where you're coming from. But I don't think accidents should count. Really, anybody fall off a four-story building is going to get hurt, drunk or sober. In fact, it may have saved my life that I was drunk that night. So you're getting alcoholism and gravity mixed up, okay? And she was just like, okay, whatever, I'm out of here. And I thought, okay, I won. And but all that week, every time I'd have a little quiet moment, I'd picture Teddy's face saying, Jesus, Doug, what would you call interference? Brain death? Brain death? And I started thinking about brain death. Either one of those two accidents, if I had landed differently, could have ended in brain death. And three other serious accidents I had could have ended in brain death. And the next one very well may. And there will be a next one. There always is. If I keep drinking, I could end up in a bed or a wheelchair the rest of my life, unable to feed myself or go to the bathroom by myself. And know it. And know it. And that is about as scary a thought as I can think of today. Let alone when I was actually drinking, when I was heading towards brain death. So I went to check out AA. And I, like I said earlier, I didn't come here to get sober. I didn't want to stop drinking. What I actually wanted, well, I went to the meeting to see what it was because I'd never been to one before. And I had heard of the 12 steps. I had no idea what they were, but I thought maybe there was two of these steps, two or three that I could apply to my seriously cutting down. Because my agenda was nothing like stopping drinking forever. What I was looking for was to not necessarily drink every day, but if I do, not get in trouble and have a cold beer on a hot day, like people do, a glass of wine with dinner. Young man, I'll have the porterhouse, that 12-ounce porterhouse, please, medium rare, and a nice dry red to go with that, perhaps a Beaujolais or a Pinot Noir. A Petite Syrah sounds good tonight. What year Petites do you have? You know what I'm talking about? Responsible adult beverage consumption. That's what I'm looking for. A little sake with my sushi. A little margarita with my enchilada. Or sometimes get a fifth of whiskey and chug it down and have an inappropriate experience. But just not every day. And that's what I've been having more inappropriate experiences than appropriate ones. So I went to AA to check it out. And I got there early. It was an 8 o'clock meeting. And I got there about 6:30 because I didn't know if I had to pay some fees or, you know, fill out some forms. I really had no idea what it was going to entail. So I got there early enough to watch people setting up chairs. I didn't help anybody set up chairs. I just leaned against the wall looking irritated, you know, like I dare you to talk to me. And I didn't really want anybody to talk to me. I wanted to sit and land, lean against the wall and observe them. And the people would come up to me and say, you're new, right? And I'd say, no, get out of here. Go away. And most of them went away. You know, most people don't want to bother with somebody that doesn't want to be bothered. But this one guy, Hank, came up to me, he goes, you're new. And I said, no, I'm not. And he goes, oh, really? I haven't seen you here before. What's your name? And I said, my name's Doug, and you haven't seen me here before. Because I've never been here before. So, mystery solved, take a hike. And he said, oh, never been here before. That's new to us, man. You're new to us, right? Okay, all right, that's fair. I'm new to you. I'm new like I've never been here before, but I'm not new like a new member, okay? Because I am not a joiner. I'm a loner. I'm an outlaw, pal. A desperado. You know what I'm saying? A misfit. I never fit any place in my life. I didn't fit in school. I barely fit in the workplace. I barely fit my own goddamn family. So I'm certainly not going to fit here in Alcoholics Anonymous, for Christ's sake. Hug, hug. Laugh, laugh. Isn't it good we're not drinking? Just kill me now. No, I like drinking. Hey, pal, I drank on the way here. I don't know if you can smell that, but that's the way it is. Absolutely plan on drinking on the way home. So I'm pretty sure I'm not your target market. Why don't you go help somebody else? And you know what he said? I like you. Yeah, yeah, you're going to fit right in, man. And I thought, Jesus, could I have been any more articulate about how I'm not going to fit in? But of course, the more you press that you're not going to fit in, the more you fit. They know you fit, you know, because non-alcoholics don't do that. Non-alcoholics never go to an AA meeting to find out if they're an alcoholic. It just doesn't occur to them, you know. We're different. Like after I got sober, and I was sober a little while, I had a drink for a little bit, and I had a sponsor, and I said, you know, Jim, I'm not really sure that I'm really an alcoholic. And he said, really? I've heard your story, Doug. I think you qualify. He said, have you ever had one drink and stopped? Yes. Yes. One time, my girlfriend and I went out for a Mexican dinner, and I had a margarita. And I didn't have a Mexican coffee after, and I didn't have anything to drink when I got home, because I was carving this bird that I had to deliver in the morning. And if I started drinking, I wouldn't finish it. So I stayed up all night finishing this bird, and I had that one margarita, and I nothing to, after that. And he goes, when was that? I said, that was 1978. And he said, see, now most non-alcoholics don't even remember the last time they had one drink and not anymore. But if they did, they wouldn't have to go back 9 years. Okay, all right, I'll buy that. But anyway, so I'm at this meeting, and people are starting to sit down. They say, there's some empty chairs up here if you want. I say, yeah, I've been here since 6:30. I see people come in, they put down a jacket, keys, purse, no keys, no jacket. That seat's available. I'm a figure outer. I'm okay standing back here at the back in case I have to leave. I don't want to cause a big scene. Pardon me, excuse me or anything. And during about that time, a guy came in, and he was leaning against the wall with me. Not with me. We were on either side of the double doors back there. And I'm looking around while everybody's starting to sit down, and I thought, you know who we are? Me and this guy are the cool section here. Everybody, all these lames are sitting down, you know, getting ready for the meeting, and we're just back here being cool. And we were so cool, we didn't even talk to each other. We're like, dude. And so they started the meeting, and people read stuff, you know. And it's funny, I was looking for those 12 steps. They were hanging on the wall. I didn't see them there. They read chapter 5. I didn't hear it there. What I heard in chapter 5 was honesty. Honesty. Rigorous honesty. People who can't get sober seem to be constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. Honesty. Rigorous honesty. And I thought, just shut up. Because I'm not attracted to honesty. And it's not my default mechanism either. Before I got sober, probably the most honest thing I ever said in my life was when my daughter's mother said to me, all right, tell me the truth, Doug. Did you sleep with my sister? And I said, not a wink. Anyway, rigorous honesty. And then they read some other stuff. But one thing that happened that meeting right away was the secretary said, we have a birthday tonight. And I thought, birthday? We have a birthday for Ruth for 18 years. And I thought, well, that's cool. I never knew they celebrated people's birthdays. So I'm looking around for Ruth, some 18-year-old tiny Heidi, you know, so I could say happy birthday, Ruth. Woman standing up, she's walking towards the front. She's 50 if she's a day. And she's clearly, that's Ruth. And I thought at first, if she's 18, she needs to stop drinking. It's not working for her. But she didn't look bad. She looked good. She's dressed up, you know, she's made up and coiffed. You know, she's taking her cake. She's celebrating tonight. But I didn't know any of that. I thought, oh, wait a minute. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. They don't drink here. I bet you Ruth hadn't had a drink in 18 years. That's what a birthday is. And I thought, well, happy birthday, Ruth. And I cued the choir. See, I didn't know you people sang here. And I don't know if you do that in Norfolk, but they do it all over in California, Southern California anyway. And so everybody, 200 people started singing, happy birthday to, and really bad. They were 200 people singing happy birthday in four different keys at the same time. I told you I'm a musician. I noticed things like this, you know. And many of these people were not even committed to the key they started in. So I'm like, God damn. And so I there was a piano on stage. I thought, maybe if I get on the piano, get everybody in the same key. Then I thought, how often does that hero thing work out for you? Why don't you shut up? It's a short song. Okay, well, happy birthday. Keep coming back. So Ruth gets up. She says, my name's Ruth, and I'm an alcoholic. And of course, everybody goes, hi, Ruth. Oh, geez. This is some level of lameness I never knew was available to me. And I looked over at the other cool guy to see if he's laughing at Ruth, who, by the way, said, I want you to know that over these last 18 years, I've attended a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every single day. And I thought, well, you're a little slow, aren't you, Ruth? I don't know if I want this thing. But I know if I do, it's not going to take me every day for the next 18 years. And I didn't even know you could go to a meeting for every day, let alone for 18 years. But I'm looking at this other cool guy when I realized, and by the way, he was singing with him. So I may be the only cool one in the room. He's a member. I don't know why he's standing at the back. Maybe he's got the newcomer catcher commitment or something. But now he's heading over to me, grabs me by the hand, and he says, hey, I'll tell you what. Stay sober a year, we'll give you one of them cakes. One of them cakes. Oh, really? All I have to do is not drink for a year and I get a cake? Woo! Woo! I mean, because it seemed to me like if you don't drink for a year, they ought to give you a car. You know, really a cake. But I was so shocked I couldn't even make fun of them. I said, I'm not much of a pastry eater, pal. If I wanted a cake, I just, you know, stop at Safeway on the way home. I think they're like $5. Or I could not drink for a year. Let me think. So anyway, but the secretary at one point held up this book. She held up this book and she said, this is our big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. The basic text of our program, the only authority on AA is this book. And she said, if you're new here tonight, please don't leave without the book. So I thought, okay, we established that I'm new, so I will steal that book. It was over on a table, you know, with some other stuff. And I figured the hardcover book, probably $20 or $25. She said, we sell it at our cost. And I said, not to me, honey. I'm taking it. I'm just taking it. I'm going to pick it up, act like I'm fascinated, read it, walk right out the door working with others. Well, that sounds like a great idea. And I thought, even if they noticed, I've had a feeling they'd say, let them go. And I still think that would have happened. But she screwed it up. She said, if you're new tonight, please don't leave without this book. If you're financially embarrassed, we understand that. We've been there. We want you to have the book. We'll make very liberal credit arrangements, including nothing down and nothing a week until you get back on your feet. And that sounds loving and generous, unless you're going to steal the book. And now, if I steal the book, you're going to think I'm homeless, you know? So Now I got to buy the book. That's probably $20-25. It's, you know, I don't care what it costs. I'm buying that book tonight. I got to stay to the end of the meeting and buy this book. I don't care how much. If I have to write a bad check, I'm buying this book tonight. So after the meeting, I went up to her and I said, lady, can I buy one of your books? She said, oh, the big book? Yeah, the big book. Yeah, I've seen bigger. How much is that big book? She said, it's $4.65. Do you have it? It's $4.65. I think I can handle that. Here's a five. Keep the change. She said, I'll get your change. I said, no, please. Keep the change and use that, you know, to help a drunk or something. Because I'm on my feet, okay? So I got my big book. And on the way home, I stopped and got a bottle of whiskey. And I went home and I poured three fingers of whiskey and I started to read this book. Doctor's opinion, I've had doctor's opinion. Bill's story, who cares? Chapter two, there's a solution. That's a sales pitch. Chapter three, this could actually be the most boring piece of literature in the English language. And so I'm already up to chapter four, which as you may know, is called We Agnostics. And I got to tell you, when I walked into my first meeting, I didn't expect to hear anything about God. You know, I thought it was going to be about drinking and not drinking. But, you know, you're not there 5 minutes and you hear my higher power, power greater than yourself, humbly asked him with a capital H, admitted to God, prayed to God, told God, oh my God, God, the last house on the block is Sunday school. And I'm just very irritated. My grandmother was a Pentecostal minister. First, she was a drunk. She was a drunk for all the time my mother was being raised. And then when I was about 6 years old, she found Jesus. And she quit drinking and smoking, picked up the cross, and lived the last 37 years of her life doing basically what we do. Trust God, clean house, help others. She opened a Skid Row mission in San Pedro, California, the LA Los Angeles wharf. And she helped hundreds of people, drunk or not drunk. And she hated AA. So that's why I thought there was no God here. And so when, you know, I can't, oh, but now there's the whole chapter called We Agnostics. And that got my attention. And there's a sentence in We Agnostics that says, we found that God does not make too hard terms on those who seek him. And that got my attention to the extent that I went back to AA. I never heard anybody say that. All the religions I thought I knew about, Western and Eastern, I never heard anybody say, we don't think God makes hard terms. Seemed like everybody said, we think God makes hard terms. And ours are different than theirs. Ours are right and theirs are wrong. And that's what all the sects of all the religions said. To my way of thinking, my drunken opinion of organized religion at the time. But I went to AA for 8 months. Not having a home group or a sponsor or reading the book or taking the steps. I didn't know what a tradition was. I didn't have a commitment anywhere. I didn't believe in God. And I was drinking every day. Yeah. Other than that, I had a pretty good program, you know. I mean, I did everything wrong except keep coming back. And I want to tell you that eventually I had a spiritual experience. I had a spiritual awakening. I fell on my knees and I spilled whiskey all over this bed. And I sucking whiskey out of the bedspread, and a voice in my head says, hey, man, that ain't right. You thirsty? There's whiskey in the bottle, man. I'm like, I'm not thirsty. I'm frugal. You know, I'll waste my life, but I'm not letting whiskey evaporate in the bedspread overnight. And I looked at myself sucking whiskey out of a bedspread, and I said, God, if you're there, please help me. I didn't even think anybody was listening. But over a couple of weeks, a series of miracles or coincidences, if you like, that's what I would have called them before they happened to me. And I came to believe that a power greater than myself would restore me to sanity, could restore me to sanity, and believe it or not, has restored me to sanity. This is what sanity looks like. And my daughter, who I disappointed time after time after time, said to me a couple of years ago when I celebrated 30 years of sobriety, you know, Dad, I always thought of you as the fun parent, but I realize now you're the one who was always there for me. And that is not true. The first 14 years of her life, I wasn't, I wanted to be there. And sometimes I was, to be honest. But times I started to go to some function at her school, and I would either show up drunk or I'd realize I was drunk and turn around and go home. And I told you about when I went to pick her up and her stepfather saved her life. And, you know, just time after time. But after 30 years of sobriety, it seemed like I was the one who was always there for her. And her mom was always there for her. Her stepfather was there for her. My family was there. Her mom's family was. Nobody, you know, she wasn't turned away by anybody. But it seemed like I was the one who was there. When my father was dying on his deathbed, I said to him, you know, Dad, do you know that everything good about me came from you? And he said, that's not true. I said, it is true, Dad. You are the one who showed me, who taught me how to be a father, how to be a son, how to be a husband, how to be a neighbor, how to be a brother. I got all that from you. And he said, well, you have AA. And I know what he meant, and he was right. Everything that my dad wanted to teach me and that I actually learned, I could not put into practice until you took me through the 12 steps and taught me how to live a sober life, taught me how to be a man of integrity, how to care about somebody, how to move from the self-centered towards a God-centered. And then I could put into practice all those things that my dad showed me. So he was right. I have AA. And I want to tell you that my friend Teddy was sober. She met and married a handsome TV star. She met him in the program. And they had a beautiful life together. And they had a beautiful little girl. And they raised her and she went to college. And when Teddy was 27 years sober, she had to have some back surgery. And when she got out of that back surgery, she had taken some pain medication, which she needed to take. But because she's an addict, she accidentally let it get out of hand. And then she was overdosing. You know, she was taking more than she should, more than she needed. And she started to go into multiple doctors. And when that didn't work, she started getting it off the street where she could. And it got way, way out of hand. And by the time she realized that she was addicted to pain pills, and she told her sponsor, she said, I got to get off these pain pills. And she said, yeah, you do. And you got to start your sober time over again. She had 27 years of sobriety. And she told me later, she said, I didn't tell my sponsor, but I thought, if I got to start my time over, I'm going to get a bottle of Jack and drink it and do it right. And she did that. She got a bottle of Jack and she drank it. And for the next 7 years, she couldn't get off of it. She couldn't. She never got 90 days sober. She would try and try and try. And she had multiple different sponsors that she tried. And she went to meetings and she got commitments and she did. But she couldn't ever get more than a couple of months sober. She'd be back on pills or back on booze. And then one day her daughter called me. Mary called me and she said, Mary was 27 years old. And she'd gotten back from college and she called me and she said, Doug, my dad said you're a singer. And I said, I am. And she said, I called to see if you would sing at mom's funeral. And I said, Teddy's dead. And she said, yeah, I came home from school and I found her dead on her bed. I don't know if she was there for one day or 2 days or what, but she overdosed. And her funeral is going to be in a few days. And I would love for you to sing whatever you want to sing at it. And I did, and I sang a song that I wrote that Teddy liked to hear and changed the words up a little bit to reflect on my love for her. And I asked her husband, Gary, you think it was suicide? And he said, I don't know. She didn't leave a note or anything. I don't really think it was deliberate, Doug, but I don't think she cared. I don't think she cared if she lived or died. And, you know, this is not a woman who who went back to the gutter. You know, she had surgery, and she innocently let the pain pills get out of hand, like so many of us do. And then she couldn't get back. And people, I've known people who slipped and slide and slip and slide. I went to a meeting in San Diego one time. It was a meeting with about 400 people and a lot of new people. It was right around where there's Volunteers of America and the Goodwill and Salvation Army. So there's a lot of new people there. And there was a guy that got up and took a cake for 9 years. And he said, I've been coming to this meeting for 18 years, 9 drunk and 9 sober. And the difference is surrender. And I can't tell you how to do it. And he sat down and I thought, God damn, that's the message. That's the message. The difference is surrender. And it's a daily thing. If you're here wondering if you can stay sober, you can. If you want to be sober 51% and want to get loaded 49%. If you want to stay sober a little more than you want to get loaded, and you'll do the things that's required here. You know, you'll get a sponsor and do every stupid thing they tell you to do. So you can end up telling somebody else stupid stuff to do someday. Chuck C. said one time, I came in here a dirty glass full of dirty water. And you started to pour a steady stream of clean water into that glass, and the dirty water was replaced. And then the glass started to clean up. And eventually I became a clean glass full of clean water. And I can't tell you when it happened. And I can't exactly tell you when it happened to me, but I've gone about 3 minutes longer than I was going to talk. And I want to thank David for inviting me. And I guess we're going to open it up to questions now. But thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Doug. That was amazing. I'm going to allow people the opportunity to unmute and thank Doug.
Thank you, Doug.
Yeah.
Thank you,
everybody.
Thank you, Doug.
Thanks, everybody.
You are an inspiration and a wonderful story taker.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to take the meeting back again. Doug, that was my story, except for I have no musical talent or ability whatsoever creatively. I'm just going to put in another plug for Larry is behind the user questions, the red question mark. So we've got a few questions queuing up, but we'll give Doug a break for now. Keep those questions coming, and we'll do a little business here. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. There's a link posted in the chat for the PayPal. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. A word about safety, our common welfare. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. I will be happy to take a couple of announcements for the good of AA. Anybody? Blue hands? All right. KP.
I'm Vince. I'm an alcoholic.
Vince.
And as of right now, Wakefield Campfire Conference is still planned for the last full weekend of September. Feel free to go to the website. It's WakefieldCampfireConference.org and register, or you can just hold off a little bit longer if you choose and make sure that that is going to be a go. But as of right now, we are planning. Also, thanks, Dad. That was awesome, my man.
Thank you, sir. Any other announcements? All right. Simple Actions is a home group where we'll have our regular meeting tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. Feel free to come back. And next Sunday, we've got somebody awesome. Tina A. from Los Angeles, California will be on the Sunday night next week. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Love you guys. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available after this meeting in the room. Please feel free to stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. Or if you're shy, feel free to send an email to info@simpleactions.net. So we got our brother Doug back. Thank you so much. That was amazing. I laughed, I cried. So we've got some questions coming in. And the first one says, do you ever chalk up your creative talents to your drinking? If so, how do you come to own your creativity and talents away from booze after you got sober? What advice do you have for a fellow artist, alcoholic in recovery?
That's an interesting question, because I one of the things I thought when I got sober was, I hope my muse doesn't die, you know, because I had written some songs. I'd written about 50 songs, and about 7 of them were really pretty good. And so when I started writing songs, I was sort of like the guy in the family afterwards that really wants to get every, you know, go out and put all his financial problems back together and everything. I was that way with my singing. I had let my, I didn't have the focus really to write any good songs towards the end. But when I got sober, before I got my guitar out, I started writing songs, but I was writing things like, oh, my sober life is so beautiful, and I thank God for it. It was just, you know, and when you're writing a song, you really don't know how good it is till you put it on some tape and listen back, and I go, well, this is shit. This is total crap. You know, I guess my muse is dead. You know, I guess my muse wasn't drunk, and my muse is dead. And about 2 years of sobriety, a friend of mine was getting married, one of my best friends, and his wife came and asked me, would you sing at our wedding? I said, I'd be delighted to. Do you have a song you want me to sing? And she said, Barney said, maybe you would write one for us. And I said, oh my God, I will try. But I haven't written any good songs since I've been sober. I'll give it my best. And if I can't, let me pick there's some good wedding songs. And she said, okay. So I started working on a song for him, and I came up with this song called Journey. And one of the choruses, every bridge I've crossed over, every tunnel I've passed through, each highway brought me closer, closer to you. I might have found some consolation on that long and rocky ride had I known my destination was here by your side. And I wrote really one of the better songs I've ever written. But afterwards, a friend of mine said, well, that's about you and AA. That's really not about Barney and Marion. And okay, all right. My muse is back. You know, AA had inspired me, and you know, I've written some, and most of the songs I've written in the last 30 years were for AA, for an AA convention. San Fernando Valley has an AA convention, big one, with over 2,000 people every February. And in 98, we started writing a musical, a one-hour musical. And we, because our area, the Sober Talent Pool, is full of writers and directors and lighting people and musicians and singers and dancers. So we were able to put on these musicals. And a friend of mine, Robin, and I wrote a lot of songs. Every musical would have five original tunes. And we had our professional musicians playing, recording the tracks for us, and then singing live on stage. And we wrote things like Big Book Boogie and 13 Step Tango and Why Him and Not, Why Me and Not Him. And Is This the Right Place? And we wrote some beautiful songs. And some of the best songs I've ever written were for AA. But I could not, if I was performing when I got sober, I don't think I could have gone back in the bar. But I know musicians who got sober on a Thursday and went to work Friday and played, you know, five sets, or went on the road. I know musicians that, you know, were playing in bands that were on the road. Eric Clapton did that. Eric Clapton was a bad, fallen down, dope addict drunk. And he said when he got sober, he was 3 days sober and he had to perform. And he could do it because music was in his heart, I think, more than it is in mine. It's just, it's like breathing to a real musician of that caliber. So I don't know if that answers your question or if you're a Doug Rowler or an Eric Clapton. But if you're a Doug Rowler, you might want to wait a while. And if you're Eric, go the hell back to work.
All right. So we have another question. You seem to be really good at Rule 62. Were you always like that, or have you learned that in sobriety? Any suggestions for someone who is not?
Sobriety didn't make me laugh. You know, I've had people ask me, you know, I asked you to be my sponsor because you laugh a lot. And I never have laughed very much. And I said, well, poor you, because I laughed all the way through my drunkenness. Sometimes I couldn't walk and I couldn't see, and I would lay on the floor and piss myself and laugh, you know? So that's who I am. Humor has always been a thing with me, and I am a Rule 62 guy, you know? And I love, my favorite page in the Big Book is 132. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. We recovered and been, why shouldn't we laugh? We've recovered and been given the power to help others. We think cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness. And we are sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. So it's not a veil of tears. You know, if you were miserable through all of your drunkenness, you may not be a barrel of laughs when you get sober, but you can be of use. And, you know, and maybe you will be. Maybe it'll open up that laughter door for you. I was, in fact, I worked as a comedian part of my drunken years.
All right. So I think somebody missed your sobriety date. So that's an easy one. And then I have another question. Can you share some of your 11th step practices?
My sobriety date is June 7th, 1987. And so I just celebrated 33 years, a little over a month ago. And my 11th step practice, here is my 11th step practice. I don't currently have a meditation discipline. I have had several over the years, different ones, 10 minutes here in the morning, 10 minutes twice a day, for a while, 20 minutes twice a day when I was working with Howard Polans, who was who insisted on 20 minutes twice a day. And it's a good practice. My wife does that at least 20 minutes once a day. Plus she meditates with some other people. I don't currently have a meditation practice. And I had to do a talk on the 11th step one time at one of these talks where they have a different speaker for each step. And I was asked to do the 11th step. And I started calling old timers that I respected. And do you have a meditation practice? And of course, Howard said I do 20 minutes twice a day. Some other people said I do 20 minutes once a day. A couple of people that said I do 5 minutes, either once a day or twice a day. My sponsor said, no, I don't. My friend Ken Devaney said, yes, I do have a meditation practice. I said, what is it? And he said, it's Amnesty. And I said, Amnesty, that's your mantra? And you said, no. When I see someone, I say you, I say, Amnesty means the God in me salutes the God in you. And so currently I don't have a sobriety, a meditation practice, but here's my 11th step. When I wake up in the morning, I roll out of bed on my knees. Unless there's an emergency, the house is on fire or something like that, I roll out of bed on my knees, say, good morning, Father. Thank you for another day. Let me see your will for me today and give me the power to carry it out. Sometimes I'll add things in between like, thank you for my life and my wife and my sobriety, my family and my friends and my home group. And then sometimes there's somebody, like if David said, Doug, my sister's going through surgery, would you pray for her? I think it's rude to say, I'll pray for God's will for her, David, because it's not going to give him any hope. So I'll say yes. And then in my prayers, my morning prayers, I'll say, and this is a prayer for David's sister. And so that's what my morning prayer is. And throughout the day, before a meal, sometime, and before the serenity prayer, before the closing prayer, anytime during the day, sometimes setting at a stoplight, help me see your will for me and give me the power to carry it out. And that's the only prayer worth praying. Some people call the 11th step prayer the prayer of St. Francis, the 11th step prayer. To me, the 11th step prayer is, let me see your will for me and give me the power to carry that out. Give me the vision and the power. And so that's my 11th step practice. It's pretty meager.
Thank you. Okay, we have another question. I am a parent and your story about your daughter mirrored mine. How do I handle the guilt, shame, and remorse I have over how I treated my kids while I was drinking?
One thing I did, I started to say at my sponsor's direction, it wasn't. I heard somebody else say they did this. So my daughter loved me. She never stopped loving me, but she was cautious, you know. Once burned, 50 times burned, you know, once shy. So I started sending her a postcard or a letter once a week. And I don't mean a long letter. Sometimes they were fairly long. Was whatever I did during that week, excuse me, or what I wanted to say about her. Or let's say I went to see her in a play and I would send her a note, you know, a card about how much I enjoyed the play. But every single week I would mail her a letter or a card. And she only lived 15 miles away. It's not like she lived in a different state. I heard it from somebody whose kid did live in a different state. But it started to open up our communications more. And sometimes, and we talked on the phone sometimes, you know, during the week. But it just got so, actually, she told me the same time that she told me I was the one who was always there for her. She said, you know, I you weren't much fun when you got sober. She's a writer. She's a columnist for a paper in Santa Barbara. And she wrote a column about her dad turning 30 years sober. And she said, when he first turned sober, I thought the fun guy was gone. I said, I guess I was solemn. I didn't realize I was, but it came back. And so, you know, but pay attention to him. Pay attention to him. Don't force yourself on him. But I found out that card or a letter every week is something that just opens up that line. You know, it's not pressy, not pushy, and it takes time, and they start communicating back to you.
Thank you. Is there such a thing as having too many sponsees?
I don't know. I mean, a lot of people I know, they get, I have 10 sponsees. I tried to keep it at 8 for a while. No, I didn't try to. It just happened to stay at 8. If somebody would get drunk or die, another one would come along. Right now, I have 10 guys that call me sponsor, and I don't actively sponsor them every day. You know, the new ones I want to call me every day. Clancy, the way Clancy asks that question, my God, Clancy, how many people do you sponsor? He says, one too few. And a lot of guys I know, like Earl Hightower, for instance, sponsors an awful lot of people. And what he will do generally, if some new person comes up and asks him to sponsor him, he'll say, I have more than I can comfortably pay attention to right now. But one of my sponsees is very good, and he will turn them on to them. And that's, I haven't had to do that yet. However, I sponsor a guy from Ireland in my home group, and he sponsors more people than I do because he's one of these guys that goes to the meeting. Anybody that walks in the door that he doesn't recognize, he goes up, how you doing? I'm Seamus. How you doing? Good to be a first time at an AA meeting, or have you been here before or whatever? Do you have a big book? You know, and so people get to know Seamus. And I always think, I need to do what he does. But I don't. I go to a meeting, start talking to my friends.
What's your typical approach with in let's say normal times, non-pandemic times, but you got a new sponsee, brand new person, will you sponsor me? And how do you approach that? Take them through the steps.
Well, it depends a lot. Lately, most of the sponsees that I've gotten in the last couple of years were already sober for a while, and just needed to either change sponsors, or the sponsor died or moved away or something. So unless they want to, we usually won't go through the steps if they're sober 15 years or something. But with anybody who's new, who's under 2 years, in fact, there's a guy I'm sponsoring now who's sober 5 years, and we start talking about the steps. I don't think he's ever done the steps according to the big book. So we're starting to do that. And about a year ago, a guy asked me to sponsor a guy from Israel. And his native language is Hebrew. And he has an English big book and an English 12 and 12, but he's more comfortable reading Hebrew. So what I do with new guys is I sit down and we each have a big book, and I'll read a paragraph or two, and then he reads a paragraph or two. And then when we get to some action, some suggested action in the book, he does that. And this guy, instead of he reads and I read, he used his Hebrew book, and I would use the English book, and I would do all the reading, and he would follow along in Hebrew. And it was an interesting thing. At one point, the words phenomenon of craving, in the doctor's opinion, came up, and I said, and that's a lot of English for somebody whose native language is an English, phenomenon of craving. You know, those both of those words. I said, do you understand what that means? And he said, yeah, it means like something you have to do if you want to or don't want to, and you can't help it. I said, well, that's exactly right. I couldn't have said it better. He said, it's written right here in Hebrew.
That's awesome. Well, we are at the end of our time. This has just been delightful, Doug. I'm going to give you one more question to close on, or you can do whatever else you want with it. But I wonder if you could share a couple of thoughts about what being a home group member means to you.
My first home group was called the San Fernando Group, and it's as old as I am. It started in 1945, the year I was born. And when I got there in 1986, before I got sober, I walked in there, and it was a kind of a rustic feeling room, and you know, it was all wood paneling and wood floor and rafters in the ceiling, and the part, and it seemed to me the members were primarily cowboys and scooter trash and housewives, and I have always related to cowboys, scooter trash, and housewives, so so that was my home group for about 4 years, and then I started. I went to this morning, the 7 a.m. meeting, which a couple of friends had, had recommended, and I went there. So my friend Howard, a recovering Hell's Angel, could give me a birthday cake when I, on my fourth birthday, and I walked in. I got the hiccups. I walked in that room before 7 a.m. and I looked around, and there were four people in there whose speaker tapes I owned, because I was a big speaker tape guy at that time. I loved to listen to speaker tapes. And there was four people in that group whose speaker tapes I owned. I had heard them talk, so I stayed there, and I started going to that meeting every day. And that was in, 1992. And I don't know, I'm not sure when I decided that was my home group, but at some point along the way, a friend of mine named Leo said, "Doug, why do you call San Fernando your home group? You go there twice a week, you're here every day." And I thought, that's true. This is my home group. So that's been my home group. And it, I love that group, man. I think it's the best group in the country. It's every morning at 7 a.m., every day of the year, Christmas, New Year's Day, St. Patrick's Day, Thanksgiving, we're always there at 7 a.m. People have commitments, and we're online. It used to be there would be anywhere from 80 to 100 people there every morning. Now there's like 110 to 140 because we're on Zoom, and it's just the age range in sobriety is from one day to almost 50 years. So about 48 years, I think, is the 47 or 48 years is the longest. Several of us over 30 years. A bunch of people, the new secretaries are pretty much in the 5 to 10 year range. You know, we have Black, white, and Hispanic, and Asian, and gay and straight, you know, we just got a good cross section of humanity in there, and good, serious Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's what my home group is to me. And we have two parties a year, twice a year, once around the Christmas time and once in the summer. Well, this year we didn't have a summer party, obvious reasons, but we have a party, and it's great for the new people to come and sort of hang out with us in a non-meeting setting, you know, where it's like a drinking party, only there's no drinking, and it's a potluck, and everybody brings food, and it's almost like a contest between the potluck, you know. Anyway, it's just, I love my home group. And if anybody wants to, you know what, I'll see if I can pick it up and put the link in the chat room. Here, I'll tell you what, if you go to our website, I'll put it in right now. Our website is www.waacolfax.com. Did I spell everything right? waacolfax.com. Too many W's there. Yeah. So if you go to that website, there's a link to our morning meeting. And we're there at 7 a.m. every morning, 10 a.m. for you. So that's good. You don't have to get up at the crack of dawn.
Right on. Thank you so much. That was amazing. So I'm going to just take the meeting back. I'd like to thank everybody who participated. Larry, for doing the questions. After the Lord's Prayer, I'll unmute everybody and give you the opportunity to thank Doug one more time. And I wonder if BJ would read a vision for you.
I'd love to. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is BJ. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you so much, Doug. That was incredible. A Vision for You, Big Book, page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you, BJ. Thank you again, Doug. Thank everyone. Let's have a virtual circle and virtually hold hands and close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
Hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.